Why don't we open our Bibles then to Judges 15 and 16. See, the reason I tell you these things is because you come Wednesday nights and you're the real, you know, faithful people. And this way, tomorrow you can call people in the church and say, hey, you interested in going on one of those trips? What trips? Oh, you didn't hear about the trip? Oh, well, you'll have to wait until Sunday in the bulletin. Then just hang up, you know. Or then you can call back later in the afternoon and say, are you going to the Chronicles of Narnia movie? The Lion... What? Oh, excuse me, there's somebody at the door. And so anyway, Judges 15, we're going to try and get through Judges 15 and 16, finish the story of Samson. Why Delilah? Not too many girls named Delilah, although there is a woman named Delilah in our fellowship. She goes by the name Dee, of course. Not too many boys named Samson, for that matter, and if you don't know why, you will after tonight. Samson had just gotten married, not to Delilah, but to a Philistine woman who caught his eye in the city of Timnah. His wedding feast ended with his new wife betraying his riddle to the invited guests. While he was off in a furious rage hacking up Philistines, his wife was given to his best man. The last verse of chapter 14 says, and Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. I don't want to defend or justify his wife's actions at all, but we can learn from the situation. I want to review Samson's relationship with his wife. Some of you were here last week, or you can read about it, but these were some of the high points. Samson had not cut the cord with his parents and fully committed himself to the marriage. At one point, she said to him, tell me the answer to the riddle, and he said, I haven't even told my parents, meaning, my parents are more important to me than you are. I certainly would have told them first and then you. And so he had no idea of leaving father and mother and cleaving to his wife. Secondly, obviously he kept secrets from his new wife and didn't bring her into his understanding of things. Third, his attraction to her was mostly surface. It was mostly, it was all surface and physical. They spent no time getting to know one another. You remember, he saw her, said to his parents, I want that woman. Go get her for me. He'd never even spoken to her. After she was terrorized into betraying the answer to his riddle, he called her his heifer. It was kind of poetic, but interesting. I love it. And then he went off in a rage and killed a bunch of people. It's not hard to see why she would prefer the company of another man. And it sounds funny, but this is the complaint, not these particular things, but these are categories of complaints that many women have when they come in, for counsel. Their husband won't come in with them, and they come in and they say, well, my husband, you know, he spends all of his time with his parents or talking to his parents. He hasn't cut the cord with his parents. And oftentimes that's true. And he's got a bunch of secrets that he's not really sharing with me what's going on in his life. He never tells me what goes on at work. And he seems more interested in the way I look than in the real me. He makes all these fascinating comments to me like, have you gained weight? Are you gaining weight? And, those kinds of really endearing things. You know, if truth be told, after you counsel for a while, he says, well, he calls me names. And we get into some real fights here, and he calls me things that are unpleasant, that I don't want to repeat. And oftentimes he goes off in a rage. And so, after a while, I'm not defending it at all. And I tell women, I said, man, I'm really sorry for you. I wish you would have talked to me before you got married. But you didn't, and so now here's some good counsel for you about how to endure a bad situation. But, I understand that women don't really respond very well to that. They don't like to stay with those kinds of men. And so we want to learn from this situation. And so verse 1 of chapter 15, after a while, it was the time of wheat harvest. It happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. And he said, let me go into my wife, into her room. But her father would not permit him to go in. Samson hadn't seen her at all for quite some time. He went down, he killed a bunch of Philistines, he brought back the bloody coats that he told him he would give them if they guessed his riddle up there in Timnah, and then he split. And then at the time of the harvest, he comes back with a young goat as a gift. He shows up with this gift. I don't know, maybe I'm told this was a pretty exciting gift in those days. This is like something from Warner Company goats, you know. So he brings this Warner goat, and he thinks he's going to go in and have sex with his wife, who he didn't even really know. And the last time he brings her a goat, the last time he saw her, he called her a heifer. So, you know, this is really, he's pretty dense and very selfish. And her father said, "I really thought that you had thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she?" "Thanks, Dad. Please take her." And say, "I don't know, you know, if you're the two sisters here, yeah, your younger sister's better than you. And hey, why don't you, Samson, just take her? I mean, this is weird. Other people can tell a lot about how you really feel towards your spouse by how you treat them." Now, Samson's father-in-law was a just man and was willing to give Samson his younger daughter, and presumably as a wife. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt. I mean, this was a culture we don't really understand much, and they're always trying to get people married off. And he said, "Hey, you know, her older sister now is with this other guy. How about the younger sister? I'm having trouble dumping her, but, you know, maybe you could marry her." I mean, I don't know who would want Samson as a husband, you know, but maybe a steady stream of goats would be coming in. Who knows? I don't know. Samson refused to take any blame for his failed marriage. Verse 3, "And Samson said to them, 'This time I'll be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them.' Then Samson went and caught 300 foxes, and he took torches, turned the foxes tail to tail, and put a torch between each pair of tails. And when he had set the torches on fire, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and olive groves." Now, this is a truly amazing piece of vandalism. I mean, this is really the most amazing night of vandalism probably in the whole Bible. And just as a note, the word for foxes could be translated jackals. I don't know why that's important or if that's important to you, you know, so he's out all night catching pairs of jackals and then tying their tails together with lit torches and setting them loose into these fields. And so the Philistine crop and harvest and everything was just burning and ruined. And then the Philistine said, "Who has done this?" And they answered, "Well, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion." So the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. Talk about holding parents accountable. In this case, they held the in-laws accountable. And I mean, there is something, even in our law, there are times when parents have to be held accountable for the actions of their children. And that's what these guys said, "Hey, well, we're going to burn you down." And so they did. What the Philistines did was wrong, but it does remind us that our failures at home affect other people. When we fail in our relationships at home, it does affect other people that we're involved with. For example, a lot of times over the years, people have said to me, even Christians, they say, "Look, we haven't been able to work it out. We're going to get a divorce. It will be better for our kids not to see us arguing all the time." To which I've always answered, would it be better for your kids if you just didn't argue all the time and stayed together? I mean, you know, I really can't fully comprehend blaming it on the children in the sense that we're doing this for our kids. No, you're not. If you wanted to do something for your kids, you'd go to marriage counseling, you'd figure out how to work out your marriage problems for your kids, because your kids really want you to stay together for the most part. We really want to understand that what we do isn't just about us. It's about many other people, especially if you have children. And so verse 7, "Samson said to them, 'Since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you, and after that I will cease.' So he attacked them hip and thigh with a great slaughter. Then he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Etam." Hip and thigh is apparently a graphic expression. Samson destroyed those guys. He cleaned their clock. He wiped them out. You know, there's all of these expressions that you run the gamut of how you describe something. So when you wanted to talk about it in those days, when the guys got together, they'd say, "Man, he beat them hip and thigh." Whoa, I don't understand what that means, but I don't never knew what clean their clock meant either. I mean, that seemed weird to me, but maybe you can explain that to me later on. Now the Philistines went up and camped in Judah and deployed themselves against Lehi. And the men of Judah said, "Why have you come up against us?" And so they answered, "We have come up to arrest Samson, to do to him as he has done to us." Then 3,000 men of Judah went down to the cleft of the rock at Etam and said to Samson, "Do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? And what is this you have done to us?" And he said to them, "As they did to me, I've done to them." But they said to him, "We have come down to arrest you, that we may deliver you into the hand of the Philistines." And Samson said to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves." So they spoke to him, saying, "No, but we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand, but we will surely not kill you." And they bound him with two new ropes and brought him up from the rock. Oppression seemed a better risk than hoping Samson would be willing to fight for them as their judge. After all, up until now, everything he did was for selfish motives. Maybe they should have tried to counsel Samson to realize his potential. I mean, you know, 3,000, hey, Samson, you know, there's 3,000 of us. Can you channel some of this energy into delivering us from the Philistines? I think we've got better than a fighting chance here. We'll go out with the hip and thigh battle cry if you want. You know, I mean, if you can, I mean, everybody knew what Samson was capable of when the Spirit of the Lord was upon him. And yet you couldn't really, they didn't feel like they could trust him. And so they just wanted to turn him into the Philistines. Now, Samson actually shows his faith in God by allowing himself to be bound. He evidently believed and understood that God's Spirit would come upon him and give him a victory over the Philistines. So even though Samson is really a very strange character in terms of being in the flesh and doing all these things, he really does have a love for the Lord and he has a relationship with the Lord. And this is a challenge to us because we feel like when we say that, we're condoning somehow his sin or his activity. No, we're not. We're just reading what actually happened. And in this case, Samson had faith. He knew that those ropes couldn't hold him and that this would be an opportunity for him to get back at the Philistines. And so when he came to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds broke loose from his hands. He found a fresh jawbone of a donkey. I mean, those are laying around all over the place, right? I mean, I knocked over three of them on the way here. But he found one, and he reached out his hand and took it and killed 1,000 men with it. The Philistines were the most advanced metal workers of that day. They had the very finest weaponry, armor, swords, weapons, they had it. Their weapons meant nothing to God. In Judges chapter 3, Shamgar killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad, with a wooden pole. Here, 1,000 are killed with the jawbone of a donkey. Later on, David would slay their fierce champion, Goliath, with a smooth stone and a sling. God uses the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, the weak overcoming the strong. He wants it made known that it's not by might nor by power, but by His Spirit. And so here's Samson out there. And remember, Samson's probably a little guy, nondescript. He's not a big muscle-bound guy. And he's bound, and Philistines come against him shouting, and he just breaks the bonds, and he picks up the jawbone of an ass that's handily by, and he just goes to town on these guys and just cuts them down, 1,000 men. I mean, just picture that, if you would, for just a minute, just the carnage of it. Just, I mean, killing a guy with the jawbone of a donkey. It's brutal. And then multiply that 1,000 times. I mean, it's crazy. Just a political comment here. I am glad we are the world's superpower, but we need to look to God or else our weaponry is useless. It doesn't matter if we had all the nuclear bombs. It really wouldn't matter. If we turn away from God, God can use the jawbone of a donkey to destroy our country if he needed to. And so we really need to seek the Lord as a nation. And then verse 16, Samson said, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey, I have slain 1,000 men." And so it was when he had finished speaking that he threw the jawbone from his hand and called that place Ramoth Lehi. The poetry of verse 16 is something like, with the jawbone of an ass, I have piled them in a mass. No, seriously, it is. That's what it really is. So Samson is not really a gifted poet, okay? One commentator says the name Ramath Lehi means jawbone heights. And so he's not a poet, but he is a humorist or a satirist. And so he kills all these Philistines, and then he names the place Jawbone Heights for later subdivisions. Hey, where do you live? You go down there to Lehi, and I live in Jawbone Heights. And it's pretty crazy stuff. Verse 18, then he became very thirsty. So he cried out to the Lord and said, you've given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant, and now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised? So God split the hollow place that is in Lehi. Water came out, and he drank, and his spirit returned, and he revived. Therefore he called its name En-Hakkor, which is in Lehi to this day. And he judged Israel 20 years in the days of the Philistines. There's always too much of the flesh in Samson, even when he's calling upon the Lord. I mean, here he is, this tremendous victory the Lord gives him, and just, Lord, you know, I'm going to die of thirst. I mean, it reminds you of all the mumbling, grumbling prophets that thought that, you know, their burden, it was just too burdensome serving the Lord. And, you know, Elijah running out into the wilderness saying, I'd rather die. I'm just going to sit here and die because of what you're putting me through. And so there's just too much of the flesh. Here he is over worried about his thirst. I mean, he had just killed 1,000 men with a jawbone because God had come upon him. Do you think God could give him a drink of water? I mean, probably so. And so he's just overly concerned. And God would provide for him. And this is a high point in the story, in a sense, because Samson did give God the glory, even though he complained about the how hard it was on him. Now, Lord, you know, it was tough killing those 1,000 guys. I'm thirsty from it. You know, and you didn't give me a canteen and stuff. But he does give God the glory. And he goes on to judge Israel, apparently, for 20 relatively peaceful years. After you kill 1,000 men with a jawbone, they leave you alone. It's like that word gets out among the Philistines and they say, why don't we just leave Israel alone for the next 20 years? Samson had a real love for God. And again, I say this, we hesitate to mention it because it sounds like we're condoning his sin. But we're not. And remember last week we talked about how Samson is just an exaggerated version of ourselves in many ways. I mean, we still sin. Hopefully we don't sin to the level that Samson sins. But we still sin, and God still loves us, and we love Him. And we don't go around, you know, condemning one another. But so this is a high point, obviously. He defeats the Philistines. Israel has peace for 20 years. Verse 1 of chapter 16, now Samson went to Gaza, and he saw a harlot there, and he went into her. Note to self, don't go to Gaza. I mean, the whole thing falls apart now in just a few verses. After 20 years, wherever you might be tempted, don't go there. Now, I hate that expression. That's one of you know these expressions like think outside the box, we're on the same page, my way or the highway. I mean, there's a bunch of expressions that just get overused. Even Christian, you know, what would Jesus do? All of these things. And I don't like the expression don't go there. You know, when somebody starts to say don't go there. But it fits in this one. I mean, don't go to Gaza. I mean, and I'm not necessarily talking about a location on the map. It could be, but something in your life that is a weakness. Don't allow yourself to go there if you know that there's going to be a problem. Samson had a problem with women. It's obvious. He saw women and he wanted them, and it didn't matter whether they were the right woman or not. At least the lady from Timnah, she wasn't a prostitute. She was just a nice-looking gal that he wanted to marry for, you know, physical reasons. Apparently now he goes down and he sees this prostitute. And so, he, you know, just don't go where there are prostitutes if you're going to have trouble with that. You know what you have problems with, right? I mean, we do. I mean, don't lie to yourself. You know where you have problems. Just don't go there. Calvary Chapel, they've got a page of stuff about the internet, you know, they're talking about all these filters and different things that you can have to try and protect yourself from pornography and all these different things. And then they're at least honest at the end. They say, now listen, you can get all of this stuff and still be drawn in, because nothing is perfect, and just because you have a filter doesn't mean you're not going. And the guy who's writing it, he says, so some of you shouldn't be on the internet. And you think, well, okay, I guess I can't go there then, you know, or I have to really strategize about, you know, I have to have the computer like broadcast, you know, to the throughout the house while my family is watching it or something, and all. And so there are places and ideas and things that you just can't do. And so quit doing that. And so verse 2, when the Gazites were told Samson has come here, they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. Now these guys are brave. It's an ambush, but they're brave. And they were quiet all night, saying, in the morning when it is daylight, we will kill him. Samson lay low till midnight. Then he arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the gateposts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. In the middle of the night, Samson was empowered to uproot the gates and walk right through the ambushers. He walked a distance, I'm told, of 38 miles with a 3,000-foot rise in elevation carrying these heavy gates. I would have let him go too. I mean, here's it. We're going to get Samson. And then all of a sudden, you know, these guys are waiting till the morning, so they're asleep. And all of a sudden they hear this kind of clanking sound, and they look up and here's Samson, again, this little guy, and he's carrying the gates of the city, posts and all, just cruising by, and I believe just saying hi to him. You know, I mean, you know, just, oh, hey, how are you, ambusher? You know, hey, give me a minute here, would you? And it's like, I don't, you know, everybody's got their idea of how much these gates weighed, but they weighed a lot. And they wouldn't have had to weigh a lot for you and I to go 38 miles with them. I mean, before you bring, and he just, I'm on my way up to Hebron. See you guys up there. If you want to mix it up a little bit, I got to take these gates up there right now. You know, it's tough, but afterward it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, entice him, find out where his great strength lies and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him, and every one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. Sorek was the Napa Valley of that region. It was a wine-producing region. Wine and women had not prevented him from being God's judge in the past. We encountered Samson last time in our study. He had been involved in a vineyard. He got drunk. He was involved with the wrong women. That hadn't prevented him from being a judge. Delayed discipline can make us think that God isn't going to act at all. In other words, we get away with something, supposedly, and we think, well, I'm still serving. I'm still teaching Sunday school. I'm still married. I'm still the pastor of the church, whatever it is. So I guess God must have overlooked my sin, and so I'll just go forward and think that he's not going to do anything about it. And so verse 6, so Delilah said to Samson, please tell me where your great strength lies and with what you may be bound to afflict you. And Samson said to her, if they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings, not yet dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man. So the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings, not yet dried, and she bound him with them. Now men were lying in wait, staying with her in the room. And she said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he broke the bowstrings as a strand of yarn breaks when it touches fire. So the secret of his strength was not known. Samson loved to play these kinds of games and riddles. Don't play games with God or with God or on God's time, in the sense that he was supposed to be busy judging the Philistines, not playing games with them. Verse 10, then Delilah said to Samson, look, you have mocked me and told me lies. Please tell me with what you may be bound. So he said to her, if they bind me securely with new ropes that have never been used, then I shall become weak and be like any other man. So therefore Delilah took new ropes and bound him with them and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson, and men were lying in wait, staying in the room, but he broke them off his arms like a thread. Samson consents to being bound, thinking he could break free at any time. This is how sin fools us. We dabble with it, thinking we are handling it, not realizing that we are becoming its slave. You know, it takes a while to become a slave to sin. Not always, but usually it's a slow progression, and it takes a while to become a slave. And when you're struggling with a life-dominating sin, there are times when you say, well, I've given that up. I'm not doing that anymore. And you maybe can go a few minutes or a few hours or a few days or a few weeks. And you think, well, I've beaten that. I've overcome that. And then you fall back into it willingly and voluntarily, thinking that it's not going to bind you. And that it's you think, well, I've given it up before. I'll give it up again. And you are becoming its slave, but you don't know it. And so verse 13, Delilah said to Samson, until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me with what you may be bound. And he said to her, if you weave the 7 locks of my head into the web of the loom. So she wove it tightly with the batten of the loom and said to him, the Philistines are upon you, Samson. But he awoke from his sleep. This guy is a sound sleeper, or i.e. he was drunk. And pulled out the batten and the web from the loom. And so apparently he's stuck to the loom. Yeah, his hair is like woven into the loom, and he just gets up and rips the thing apart. Samson may have invented dreadlocks. I mean, this is a weird hairdo, I mean, basically is what you've got here. For the first time, though, he mentions something that at least connects with the source of his power. Not the hair itself, but the Nazarite vow that he would never cut his hair. And so he's really skating on thin ice, we would say. Weaving it isn't cutting it, but Samson's getting closer and closer to total slavery to sin, all the while thinking he could walk away any time. And then she said to him, verse 15, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these 3 times and have not told me where your great strength lies. Who said anything about love anyway? This is not love. I'm amazed at how quickly people think they're in love with other people. This is always a problem when you're doing marriage counseling and people have gotten involved with other people and they are in love with them after a relatively short period of time. And then, you know, when those feelings kick in and engage, it's like, well, this has to, I mean, all the country songs and AM radio songs that you've ever heard start to take control of your heart rather than the Bible. You know, this must be love. How can love be wrong? You know, how can something that feels so good be so wrong? And it's like all these cliches that come out. And I'm thinking, I mean, and I'm in the embarrassing position as a counselor saying, I really don't care that you're in love with this person. It's not love. It's a feeling. It's not biblical love. It's not God's love. It's AM love. It's country love. It's some kind of love, you know. That's why I love, and this is off the subject, but I really enjoy, we were talking about it today, I really enjoy the television program Survivor, because the people get, they're only there for 39 days, and they act like they have been there for their whole life. After a week, they form these bonds that are so deep and meaningful, and they like trust each other with their lives, and you lied to me. I'm trying to win $1 million here. What do you mean I lied to you? What are you talking about integrity? I mean, this is a game after all. I mean, there are no any rules. As long as I don't kill you, I don't see that there's any rules. They don't say you can't. I mean, so within the, but you know, and they form these relations and they hurt each other. You lied to me. Oh, whoa. Oh, spit, man. I lied to you. Whoa. I mean, it's crazy. It's insane. They've only known each other 7 days, and they act like they were womb partners or, you know, twins or something. And so these people, this is not love. This is all emotional and physical. It's a selfishness that should not be compared to real love. And so verse 16, it came to pass when she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him, so that his soul was vexed to death, that he told her all his heart and said to her, no razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up once more, for he has told me all his heart. So the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought her the money in their hand. Then she lulled him to sleep on her knees, called for a man who had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. And then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." So he awoke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as before at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. How very, very sad. That might be the saddest few words in all the book of Judges. Samson was lured and then lulled. Sin creates its own atmosphere, which when breathed or endured long enough, dulls our spiritual senses, so much so that he couldn't tell that the Lord was no longer even empowering him. Samson touched grapes. Nothing seemed to happen. In fact, God went on using him. He touched a carcass and nothing seemed to happen. In fact, God went on using him. He might have thought that he could break the third vow and have the same result. God's ways, and especially his timing, are never like ours. It's better to believe God on principle, take him at face value, than to begin to reason for ourselves about his delays. And so Samson should have thought, hey, I've blown it. I've blown two of my vows right in the first few chapters of Judges here. I need to really get it together and avoid this and just protect the, and ask the Lord to continue to forgive me and all that. But apparently he thought that the Lord was not ever going to remove his presence from him. And God, sad for him, God had other thoughts in mind. And so the next verse puts sin into perspective for us, an important verse. It says, "Then the Philistines took him, they put out his eyes, brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze fetters, and he became a grinder in the prison." First, sin blinds. Long before the Philistines put out his eyes, Samson was blind to the consequences of his sin. The putting out of his eyes was just a physical representation of what had been going on in his heart for a long time. He was blind to sin. Second, sin binds. It holds you captive. At some point, you are held captive by it. You can't break free from it without the Lord. And third, sin grinds. We talk about life being a grind, don't we? Have you ever heard that expression? My life is a grind. Well, I think it's from this episode. It's from Samson, who had so much potential and was such a great individual. And then he literally ground out grain for the remainder of his life as if he were a beast. People would like you to believe that sin frees you to become better, more human. Now, this is always the argument of the modernist. You know, we need to just be more liberal and we don't need marriage and we don't need all of these old restraints and we need to throw off all this antiquated thinking and be free and be living up to our potential and be evolving into greater human beings. And the truth is, when we get away from God's principles and standards and precepts, we devolve. We don't evolve. We go downward and become more like animals, which is really what you would expect from the theory of evolution. I mean, you either believe in evolution or creationism, and if you choose evolution, then people really should do whatever they want to each other. There's no moral standard. There's no reason to not kill people and to just be... I mean, what is the thing with evolution? It's survival of the fittest, right? I mean, that's the principle. And so... just kill somebody. What's the difference? Who cares? And I at least give existential philosophers credit for realizing this. They say, well, yeah, there's no reason to exist. You just exist. There's no God. There's no morality. There's nothing but you and your existence. So let's figure out how we can exist together without killing ourselves and killing others. And at least they're honest about that. And this is what happens when you don't have God. You become beast-like. And we see more and more people say, man, there's so many weird, perverted, deviant things going on in our world. How can that be? Well, it's because we've abandoned God. We've abandoned biblical values. And in that void, you act like an animal. God's grace is sufficient even when you sin. We see in verse 22, however, the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaven. Note to the jailer. When was the last time Samson went to the barber? Seems odd they wouldn't keep him bald, right? They probably thought, and this is my conjecture, but they probably thought that since Samson had sinned, God was through with him. They didn't believe Samson's God would restore him and use him. We are sometimes like that even as Christians. Sometimes someone sins, We sort of believe they may have repented, but we don't think that they can ever really be used by God in a similar way again. We do, and I mean, be honest, we have a hard time when believers sin, and we want to believe they've repented, but there's a part of us that thinks we should make them pay for it, that we should hold them back or discipline them or give them a long period of something. And it's hard for us to understand that God has forgiven them and restored them, especially if they're a minister or a missionary, but not confined to that. I'm not suggesting that we take grace lightly, but that we see how strong it really is. And notice that although Samson was forgiven, he went through a season of grinding. He did suffer the natural consequences of his sin. I mean, by the time he got to this place and his hair started to grow back and he's going to call upon the name of the Lord, his eyes had been put out. He was imprisoned. I mean, he was in a bad way from his sin. And so whatever it was, the Philistines weren't really paying attention to his hair. And it seems like a pretty big oversight, except they must have had a pretty compelling reason to think it was that God was just through with Samson. And so in verse 23, the lords of the Philistines gathered together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, "Our God has delivered into our hands Samson, our enemy." When the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, "Our God has delivered into our hands our enemy, the destroyer of our land, and the one who multiplied our dead." Our God's better than your God, is what was going on. This was like a sports arena, you know, and this was like their version of the wave or something. They were all chanting, "Our God's better than your God." Well, maybe something catchier than that. The world seems to have no need for God and no fear of God. If he's mentioned, it's in a derogatory way or to establish blame for allowing suffering. The suffering you need to consider, though, is God's long suffering. The reason God waits to do things, to intervene, is because he's long-suffering with sinners, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And so, you know, if somebody comes up to me and says, "Why did God allow this hurricane?" That's not what's happening at all. I mean, God allowed the hurricane when he gave Adam and Eve free will to sin in the garden. That hurricane is the direct result of sin coming into the world. God is suffering long with the human race. People are dying in these tragedies because you didn't get saved today. You might be the last person. Could be that you're going to get saved and the rapture takes place. Judgment comes upon the earth for 7 years and we get done with this thing. So if you want to know what the problem is, you're the problem. Ultimately, you are the problem if you're a sinner. The problem is sin and you're the problem. Because even Peter says we share the Lord to hasten the day of his coming. And the idea, not that we control when the Lord comes, but it's an idea and an attitude we have that there is going to be one final person that receives the Lord, and then the Lord's going to rapture the church, and he is going to get done with what he's promised to do. And so we need to have that perspective. And so verse 25, "So it happened when their hearts were merry," that means they were drunk, "and they said, 'Call for Samson that he may perform for us.' So they called for Samson from the prison, and he performed for them. And they stationed him between the pillars. And then Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, 'Let me feel the pillars which support the temple so that I can lean on them.' Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, about 3,000 men and women on the roof watching Samson perform. Samson's hair had returned, then his heart for God, and now he had a hope in God. Verse 28, he called to the Lord saying, 'O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray, just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes.' And Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple, and he braced himself against them, one on his right and the other on his left. And Samson said, 'Let me die with the Philistines.' He pushed with all of his might, and the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he killed at his death were more than he had killed in his life. And his brothers and all his father's household came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of his father Manoah. He had judged Israel 20 years." You can start strong and finish poorly. You can start weak and finish strong. Obviously, it's better to start strong and stay strong, depending upon the Lord to strengthen you instead of depending upon your own strength. Let's pray together. Father, thank you for these things. We've had a little bit of fun with some of these images and episodes, Lord. They're pretty amazing, really, when we see them for what they are. But they're the real story of a real servant of God, a man who loved you but didn't really walk in victory over the flesh. And I pray, Lord, that it would be a challenge to us and a warning to us about just how powerful our flesh is, that principle within us, Lord, that would lead us to sin. The world and the flesh and the devil, they are lures trying to lull us into a false sense of security. I pray that we'd be on our guard, Lord. We wouldn't go to the Gaza that would cause us to stumble into sin, but that we would judge our own heart and our own life and maintain, Lord, a purity and a faithfulness. And Lord, when we do fall, which is inevitable, I pray that we would know your sustaining, marvelous grace, and that, Lord, when others fall and fail, we would go to them, not to rebuke them so much as to restore them, to cover their sin, Lord, as much as possible, and put them back on a walk with you so that they can serve you and love you. And so, Lord, all these many lessons, we pray that you would bring home to our hearts. We ask it in Jesus' name, and everyone said, amen. All right.